Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Bitcoin. Have you jumped on the Bitcoin bandwagon? Do you know anybody else who has? You can't go on social media or be in almost any social setting without someone talking about Bitcoin. It's everywhere. So what are the mental processes that influence our desire to join the crypto craze? We're going to talk to a behavioral economist, Stephanie Bank, from Every, about the science behind cryptocurrency cravings. Then, it's hard to talk to your millennial teens about money with their eyes glued to Instagram all the time, scrolling, swiping, double tapping. If only there was some sort of smartphone app that could hold their attention while also teaching them about personal finance. Volio would like to claim that territory. We're going to talk to its CEO about it, how it combines stock trading and social networking. And estimating the cost of education, the price of a university degree, it's not just the tuition. You have to take into account a whole bunch of other things like textbooks and food and travel and living expenses. So we're going to take a closer look at a cost calculator to help you navigate that. Our guest, financial advisor Dan Bortolotti from PWL Capital. Plus, spending money is easy. It's the savings part that can be hard. A lack of resources, yep, definitely makes saving more difficult. But research shows that for many, the problem actually lies in psychological obstacles. We're going to learn about the behavioral science behind saving. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Whether it's Bitcoin, Ripple, Ethereum, or Litecoin, everybody is talking about investing in cryptocurrencies. It's almost impossible to scroll through your newsfeed or be in any social setting these days without cryptocurrency entering the conversation. But one thing people aren't talking that much about are the mental processes that influence our thinking around Bitcoin. What's the science behind people's cryptocurrency cravings? Stephanie Bang is a behavioral economist with Every. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there.
Why is everyone talking about investing in cryptocurrencies right now? I mean, it's clearly in the air. It's in the zeitgeist. But as it relates to our brains, what's so appealing?
So cryptocurrency is one of those things that represents a lot of other trends in investing. Anything that people hear a lot about, they see in the news, they hear other friends or people that they know who are investing in it, and it really becomes a trend. But the reason it becomes a trend and the reason people get so excited about it is because of many different psychological biases. One of the primary biases is herding. So everyone's investing in
Bitcoin. And that's H-E-R-D-I-N-G, like a herd of cows.
Exactly.
Not herding like, ow!
Yes, we follow the herd like cattle, unfortunately.
Yes, right.
So the idea is that we're all investing in Bitcoin because everyone else is investing in Bitcoin.
Or it feels like everybody's investing. Even if they're not, it feels like they are.
Exactly. When we see something that a lot of other people are doing, it validates what we should be doing.
With this particular one, because it's so recent, we can see that there was a point at which it moved from Bitcoin is for organized crime to launder money to this is something I can do on my phone. And my nephew actually literally has Bitcoin, bought Bitcoin through Coinbase on his phone. What about that shift relates to brain science?
Yeah, I mean, when we see that other people are having success with this investment, it really makes us quite emotional. So it triggers two dominating emotions. One of them is fear and one of them is regret. And those are two very powerful emotions that dictate our behavior. And a lot of research has found that when people invest in Bitcoin, they tend to become overconfident. And what happens is they invest in Bitcoin, they think it's going to be amazing, they see it's been profitable for a lot of other people, and they look for information that supports that decision, which we would call overconfidence, or which turns into confirmation bias.
Right. So all I'm looking for is what matches my worldview.
Exactly. We're going to seek out information that confirms exactly what we want to hear and believe.
What happens in our brain when Bitcoin starts to decline and the story that we were looking for confirmation for is not playing out as it should? The pain sensors are activated versus the pleasure ones.
That's a very interesting question. So people have very different reactions to investments that are declining and investments that are doing well. So if my investment is doing well, I'm going to expect that pattern is going to persist into the future. I'm going to think that, well, if it's going in a good direction now, it's probably going to continue on the same trajectory. There's a lot of research that's actually shown that when something happens just two times over, people anticipate that that's going to be a pattern. However, when you see things moving in the opposite direction, it evokes a much more emotional response. So what we would call in psychology, it's basically sunk cost. So once people are invested in something, again, they're going to tap into that over-optimism where they feel like it's just going to bounce back and it's going to get better.
How do things differ with age? And I don't mean the design of the brain or what's happening in the brain. I mean that for someone of my age, I remember viscerally the dot-com boom and bust. Whereas if you're 25 or 30, you don't remember it. You were alive, but you weren't focused on it. And I'm wondering how, if young people are more susceptible to the cryptocurrencies because they haven't seen it or experienced the boom and the bust. Mm-hmm.
As much as you might want to hear.
You're saying experience doesn't count.
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately not. So Kahneman and Tversky, Nobel Prize winning behavioral economists, their research really demonstrates that people are not rational when it comes to evaluations of risk. And even if they see that they are overly optimistic about how things will work out in the future, even if it doesn't work out in their favor, they continue to repeat the same behaviors over and over again, as irrational as that sounds.
Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Right.
Yeah.
Right. One of the big behavioral economics theories is loss aversion. So how does that relate to the crypto craze? How does that fit in? Because, I mean, people have had such – if they bought in early, they've had such enormous gains. Wouldn't loss aversion then have kicked in and said, time to sell, time to sell, cash out because you don't want it to decline? Or was the overconfidence so compelling that they would hold indefinitely?
So there was some interesting research that was done that looked at investors' behavior when the market starts to decline. And what they found is that people don't fear losses as much as they fear losing out when everyone else is getting rich. So I'm not fearful of losing a certain amount of money based on the amount of money that I invested. But if I see that other people aren't losing that money, it's much more it has a much greater impact on my emotions and my losses, because we know that losses have a much greater emotional impact than gains of equal value.
You mentioned regret earlier. There may be people who bought at the peak of Bitcoin who have some regret about making that decision, given how much it has pulled back from its highs. How does that layer into things?
People are highly motivated by regret. It's, again, with fear, one of the most powerful emotions that people have. And it's definitely a variable to consider.
One of the differences for millennials today versus, even investors 20 years ago is that there's an instant gratification on trades. They don't pick up the phone and call their broker. They can go online, do it themselves without any filter. What would you say is the influence of technology to either enable or inhibit the naturally occurring phenomena of our brains?
Yeah. Unfortunately, with today's access to information and the ability to do everything online, it's far too easy to make a rash emotional decision with every news headline that you hear. I mean, if you go back to the basic premise of investing, usually people are in it for the long haul. It doesn't really matter if the market goes up one day and down the next. But when that market does drop, people have this emotional reaction and they make a rash decision that doesn't align with their initial intentions when they first invested.
This is Bitcoin for people who buy it, as in buy the story, is a really compelling look at the future. But there are also a lot of people who buy it simply because it's in the news and it's out there. What about our the makeup of our brain has us not do our due diligence on some things, and yet we would never buy a new television without buying Consumer Reports magazine, poring over it, and then shopping every single store in the land to make sure we got the best price?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. But again, it really goes back to that herding or these social norms. So when we see other people doing something, it validates that that behavior is the norm. It validates that we should be doing that behavior too. And it doesn't really matter what other people say or seeking out other viewpoints to validate what you think you should be doing or shouldn't be doing. If other people are doing it, if it's part of the masses, then we're going to go along with that. It's just easy.
We'll just hope that cow isn't walking over a cliff. Thank you very much, Stephanie. Stephanie Bank, a behavioral economist with Every.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
It can be pretty hard to have conversations with teenagers about money, especially in today's digital era. But some financial experts say the digital age could be used as a financial literacy advantage for millennial parents. There's a new app out there called Volio, and it's trying to do that. It's a stock trading social networking app that has friends and family form and manage investment clubs. Here to tell us more is Volio's CEO, Thomas Beattie. He joins us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you.
Now, this is kind of a mind shift here. You're only available in the U.S. right now, except for your simulator app. But you're Canadian. You're based in Vancouver, right?
That is correct.
Yes. All right. So we'll be very excited when it does show up. You'll be excited when it shows up. Tell us how Volio works.
Well, Volio's a social trading application, as you've indicated, and the whole idea behind Volio is that it's collaborative in nature. We're trying to break down the barriers to entry for novice investors, those people that don't think they have enough money, enough knowledge, enough time, or are scared of the markets.
So what specifically will they do? How does that specifically work?
So they'll come together on our application. Any member can create their own account on our platform, but they can also create one for a team. They invite their family, their friends, their colleagues, their teammates, whoever it is that they know and trust, and they agree to pool some assets and start democratically managing their own private portfolio in publicly traded stocks and ETFs.
One of the great things about investment clubs is that sort of communal feel, and you're in it together, and there's a social aspect to it and all that stuff. But the club doesn't necessarily have either a clear due diligence process or access to great insight that will then drive their investment decisions. How does Volio deal with that reality that not all investment clubs are created equal?
What we're trying to do is add this element of gamification that supports financial literacy. And what I mean by that is on our system, when somebody on your team makes a proposal, the rest of the group democratically votes on it. Our system will track each person's proposals and votes. So whether the club goes on to buy that specific security or not, we're going to know who decided to do what and let them manage that hypothetical decision in the future. This enables them to learn, but also to prove to everybody else how things would have gone if everyone had listened to them.
Oh, interesting. So there's kind of this parallel world. It's like that sideway. Sliding doors, where you have two different lives based on whether or not you got off the subway or stayed on.
And that is what lives in our community. So whether you're on there as an individual investor or you're there as part of a group, you're able to gather insights from top performing individuals based on their decisions or clubs based on their actual trades in real time, not to copy, but to validate with your own trusted peers.
Now, you haven't been around for 10 years. So you don't have a 10-year read of what the returns are on these clubs. But is there enough data to get a sense for how results compare to the indices? And I ask because we see a lot of individuals suboptimize their returns. They think they're doing great, or at least that's the story they tell at cocktail parties, when in reality their returns aren't so great and they would have been better in an index fund.
Well, there's no hiding from what you decide to do on our platform. We do anonymize everything for wealth, but you're able to see transparently what each person has decided to do and what their returns look like. So there isn't enough data for us to conclusively say whether our users are outperforming or underperforming the market. But what we do know is that the teams are consistently outperforming the average of their members.
Interesting. Now, investing can be very, very intimidating. It can be very confusing. How do you try and simplify that or mitigate those concerns?
Together, we're more intelligent than we are apart. And we think that you're going to gain not only through the collective intelligence and insights of your crowd, but by lower cost through splitting fees, through lower risk by enhancing diversification versus what you could achieve on your own, and hopefully better decision making. And that's the wisdom of the crowd.
Does Voleo include a discount brokerage functionality? Is it end to end, or do you need to do that separately?
It's end to end in America. We have a subsidiary which automatically facilitates the trades, would go to market on the condition for execution. So as soon as a club votes in a majority, away it goes.
And I'm sure the system does this, but how do you clock whose piece of the portfolio is whose?
Well, that's the beauty of the technology, actually. And one of the things that used to be very difficult about running an investment club was that somebody had to track who owned how much. We link each individual and their bank account to their club and are able to mark-to-market portfolios as they contribute and make withdrawals.
There's so much that the social media world and this notion of always connected, always on has provided us. There are also downsides to that. So in an Instagram or Facebook world, we have FOMO, fear of missing out. We have people feeling inadequate because of the extraordinary contouring of the Kardashians' cheekbones. We have all those kinds of things. What are the pros and cons of bringing social to your investing life? It can't be all to the pro side.
Well, obviously, there's going to be some team that ends up buying something that doesn't go as well as they hope. And I think that's a fact of investing and one of the reasons that you've decided to work together in the first place. There's no cheekbone envy on the Voleo platform, but there certainly is an ability to gather insights from those that are doing well.
How does cost of trading work? What do you charge and how do you make your money?
So what I like to say is that nobody ever pays more than $4 per person per trade on our platform. Individual account trades are $4, and teams, whether they have 3 people or 100 people, are splitting a $12 trading commission.
Which is kind of in the game of what the traditional discount brokers are calling, not some of the low-fee ones, but if you're at a bank, it's kind of like $9 or $10.
That's right. And we figure our average user base has 9 members at the moment, so they're paying about $1.30 per person per trade.
And what sort of asset level? So 9 members, is this a $20,000 account they're playing with? Is it $20
million? Oh, I want the $20 million. They're all in the tens of thousands. We have a few that are in the hundreds. But these are people that are starting small. For many, it's their first foray into investing. And what I like about what I'm seeing thus far is that people are setting up really great financial habits. Hmm. They're about half of our users are making monthly contributions. It might be $25, might be $500, but they've set up these recurring contributions. And I think that's another fantastic element of collaboration. You've got that extra incentive from your friends to keep chipping in each month.
And this is outside of a registered plan. This is like a non-registered account. It doesn't count for a TFSA or RSP contribution.
Correct. These would be cash accounts.
Tell me about the Simulator app. How does that work?
Anybody can download Simutrader from the App Store and start investing today. You're doing it all hypothetically, including the commissions, so it's absolutely free for anybody to use. When you come in, you'll have an individual account set up for you, and you have the option to create one or more teams, invite those friends, get another $1 million of simulated currency to manage, and see how you go.
Interesting. What was the inspiration for this as a model? Are there others in other jurisdictions that I just don't know about, or did it just fell into your head?
This is a unique concept. Our founder, Jay Sudger, came up with the idea in the wake of the financial crisis. There was a lack of trust in the financial system and a sense of fear among younger users. And he thought that the best way to overcome that would be to do it together, democratically and transparently.
Very interesting. Well, Thomas, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thomas Beattie is the CEO of Voleo. He joined us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, how to stay on top of your personal finances. We're going to profile a new piece of software that attempts to manage not just your budgets, but all of your financial needs in one place. And later, the behavioral science of saving. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery. on Canada Talks. Sirius XM 167.
Budgets can be crucial when it comes to managing your personal finances. But the secret to getting your financial house in order doesn't just stop there. It includes a whole bunch of other factors. Net worth, savings rate, investments, even your taxes. And there are lots of apps out there trying to bring it all together. One of them is called Banktivity, and it is a personal finance software for Mac devices that focuses on all these factors in what they would say is one easy app. The CEO and founder of IGG Software, the company behind Banktivity, is Ian Gillespie, and he joins us now from Ashland, Oregon. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How you doing?
What is Banktivity, and how does it work?
Banktivity is a personal finance app that connects all of your accounts into one place so that you can make smarter financial decisions.
There's lots who would have a similar, you know, unique selling proposition. Banks sometimes claim that they do that. We know that they don't, but they would sometimes claim that. Something like Mint would say that. Maybe, you know, some of the bookkeeping programs like Quicken would say that. What's different? What are you endeavoring to do that is different from what's already out there on the marketplace?
Well, first of all, we focus a lot on user experience. We have apps for the Mac, iPhone and iPad, and we've developed for those platforms because we love them and we feel like we can make the best software possible. And so we try and make it really easy for people to get the whole financial picture that they have, see everything in one place, and help them make those smarter decisions. Now, the other thing that really separates us from the competition is we have some really powerful features. Mint, you know, they have some basic investment reports that you can do. With Banktivity, you can look at your performance per lot if you're into investments. We calculate your ROI, your IRR. We help you with your capital gains when it comes time to preparing taxes. If you're not at that stage in life where you're, you know, really focusing on your investments and trying to understand how they're performing, we have an incredible budgeting tool that makes it really easy to make sure that you're putting your money to work for you and making sure that you're sort of getting the biggest bang for your buck, if you will.
One of the harsh realities for consumers in the financial services space is that they/we are deal with an extraordinary level of inertia when it comes to switching outside of the bank relationship that we know and may have known for decades. How do you do that? How do you prompt people to behave in a different way when, you know, the bank app's kind of good enough and I don't want to do anything?
You know, it's an interesting question. Personally, I haven't seen one of the bank apps that really has the type of power and flexibility that's in an app like Banktivity. You might be able to aggregate a couple of your accounts in some places, but they don't do a great job of letting you add some of the other assets that might not be tied with the bank. For example, if you wanted to track the value of your home, you can easily add an asset like that into Banktivity to really fill out the picture of your net worth, for example. We also have some great metrics like savings rate, right, which is a really key metric. And some people argue that is, if you had to boil all personal finance down to one metric, which one would you choose? Savings rate is right up there at the top. It basically tells you, are you saving money or are you going further into debt?
How does it calculate that? I mean, I agree that is a crucial metric, and I would say almost no one has an idea of what they would score on that front. How does the software allow us to have a number that we could look at?
Sure. Once you've added in all your accounts, it calculates it automatically for you, and it does that by looking at your income that comes in and looking at your expenses going out. And then it also detects which things are transfers which don't have an effect on your savings rate. You know, if you take $100 from your checking and put it into a savings account, that's not affecting your savings rate. It's really about the money coming in and the money going out.
One of the big themes in fintech that's sort of been unfolding in the last year or so is the distinction between enablers and challengers of the incumbents, the legacy banks that have been around for a very long time. Where do you think Banktivity plays on that? And I know it's a false distinction. It is a permeable wall there. But using that as an idea, what would you say the role of your software is?
We don't give any advice to people about what sort of banks they want to use. Or we currently don't give advice about where you want to go out and get a loan. There are some disruptors coming out trying to make it really easy to get home loans and make the whole process more simple. What we wanted, our focus is on once you've chosen where you want to bank with and how you want to bank, we want to make it easy for you to understand and see the whole picture of those decisions.
What do you think is different about the millennial generation as opposed to the generations that preceded them in terms of how they get a handle on their money and investing in particular?
Well, I'm just on the cusp past being a millennial. My wife is right on the cusp. Mm. I don't really like to speak out about what about the millennial generation too much, mainly because I feel like you can read just about anything. What I think has been most interesting is to see the importance of this generation in the news and the media, and seeing them now, they're coming into this time where it's time to start thinking about buying a house. They're getting married. They have kids. And they're really entering in what I see as sort of a different phase in your financial life where it really starts to become a time where you really want to start accumulating wealth. You want to start thinking about, saving for a down payment for your house, saving for retirement, saving to help put your kids through college. Whatever it is, it's really a time to start focusing on building wealth.
One of the pieces on the budgeting front is sort of this notion of envelopes. They used to be paper, now they are virtual. How does that functionality work?
So in Banktivity, we have what we call envelope budgeting. I'm a huge proponent of it. I think it's really, really effective. And what it allows you to do is Banktivity makes it easy to basically take the money. So this is, the money sitting in your checking account, the money sitting in your savings account. And then it allows you to put it into these virtual envelopes of where you plan to spend that money. So let's just say my checking account balance right now is $1,000. Well, I know later on this month I got to make a payment to my cell phone company to pay my cell phone bill. And I know I'm going to have to buy some groceries. And I know that my rent is going to be due coming up. And it allows you to distribute that $1,000 into these envelopes. And then as you spend, the balance of those envelopes go down and you can move money around between them, which is really important because you will have to end up moving money around. At some point, something comes up that you don't expect. You spend more than you planned on. Something will come up, and it's important to be able to move that money around. What I love about envelope budgeting is you're giving your money a plan. You don't spend and then go, oh, gosh, I spent so much and I'm reacting. It's like, no, this is how I'm planning on spending this money.
Right. Ian, thank you for your insight. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ian Gillespie is the CEO and founder of IGG Software, the company behind Banktivity. Banktivity is available to Canadians. It connects with the big major banks here. Well, stay with us. Coming up later, the Moolala questionnaire. But next, estimating the cost of education. We'll look at the numbers from MoneyPage's post-secondary cost calculator to find out how helping your kids will affect your wallet. Still worth it. Hey, we're hanging out on the radio, but I also do a lot of TV. I'm the money columnist for CityLine on air across North America, and you can check out segments online at cityline.tv and search for me. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Tuition is only a part of the cost of going to post-secondary, university, college, whatever it is. There is a lot more to factor in. Textbooks, food, booze, public transit, living accommodations, all that stuff. So when you look at those calculators, sometimes you're not getting an accurate estimate on what it's really going to cost. We're going to focus on this topic. There's a calculator out there called the Money Pages Post-Secondary Education Cost Calculator. We're going to look at the numbers in more detail with Dan Bortolotti. He is a financial advisor with PWL Capital, the author behind the blog The Canadian Couch Potato, and most relevant to this conversation, he's a parent of grown kids. Hey, Dan.
Hi, how are you, Bruce?
You survived. Your kids have gone, they have left the nest. How did it go for you on the education savings front?
Well, it went really well. I mean, we were fortunate that we, you know, planned for this early on. We were pretty young parents, so we squirreled away a little bit of money as soon as they were born, and it wasn't a lot. I mean, we started with $30 or $40 a month, I think, we were putting away when the kids were very little, and that's all we could afford. As they got a little bit older, we squirreled away a little bit more. But by the time they got to university, we were able to cover pretty much all of their essential expenses, and they covered the rest with their own summer jobs and co-op jobs.
What would you say you learned from this experience now that they're, I don't know if they're fully through, but at least mostly through, aside from, wow, this is expensive, what do you think you learned that you could pass on to others?
Well, I think the first thing is that the calculators that are available online and the ones that you might get from a financial advisor, especially one who's trying to sell you investments, are a little bit misleading. And it's really important to kind of dig into the details, because one of the things I notice on these calculators is they often include things like food, public transportation, clothing, you know, things like that, that you're probably already paying for as a parent, right, when your kids are at home. And so this is not really an additional expense that you need to budget for in the future. The other thing is they often will lump in things like entertainment, you know, booze, you were saying at the beginning. And I think, you know, I'm more than happy to help my kids get through university, because I don't think it's really going to be affordable for most people without a little help, parental help. But I'm not paying for their booze.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, unless, of course, you're invited and you man the keg.
Yeah, exactly. So, or I provide the entertainment myself.
Yes.
That's very inexpensive. So, you know, we looked at trying to make sure that we could cover tuition and books for sure. And we did help them with rent. But, you know, above and beyond that, most kids are able to do a little bit of work in the summer, and I was fortunate both of our kids did co-op programs, and so they made decent money in between those school terms, and that helped defray virtually all of their personal costs.
How do you think about the cost of tuition, given how wide a spectrum there is? So I was looking at some of the estimates on a business program at Ivy or Queens, $64,000 for the four-year program, and those costs really outpaced other, you know, general arts programs. How do you factor that variable in, given that tuitions, that the increase in tuition across the board, it well outpaces inflation?
Yeah, and it's a good point, too, that the amount of tuition varies widely depending on the school and the program, right? I mean, I had, you know, my youngest is in a college program, my oldest is in a university program, and the difference in tuition is quite stark. So you probably want to budget somewhere in the middle. If you're comfortable saving, you know, the higher amount, great. But if you're a bit worried about that, you know, don't necessarily try to save for the Ivy business education. You can try to save enough just for a sort of college level tuition and do the best you can there. And again, if your child decides to take a program that's very expensive because it's going to lead to, we would hope, you know, a very lucrative career, then it's, I think, a little bit more reasonable to expect them to foot a little bit of that bill, because they're probably going to be coming out of school with a pretty high-paying job, and even if they need to borrow a little bit, they will be able to do so and pay it back relatively quickly.
I'm a big fan of the RESP, the Registered Education Savings Plan, and the grant that comes along with that. The details of that program have not changed materially in the last little while. Even if you max out your RESP, is it going to be enough for most families? Like, if that's kind of the, you know, the measure, do you need to save outside that?
Well, you might if you want to cover all of the expenses, right? But I did a little bit of math ahead of, you know, this discussion to kind of see that. And, you know, I looked, if you put in, say, $2,500 a year to an RESP, which is what you need in order to get the $500 maximum annual grant, and if you do that for 14 years, and you earn about 3% return over that period, you should end up with somewhere in the mid-50,000s by the time your child is ready to go to university. And that's enough to pay kind of $13,000, $14,000 a year. And again, that should kind of cover the basics, tuition and books, and even a little bit of accommodation. It's not going to pay for every single expense. But it will get very close. And I think, you know, again, if you want to do a very expensive education and you want to pay for all of it, then you might need to save outside of an RESP. But I think any parent who's able to save, you know, that $2,500 a year, take maximum advantage of the grant and all the tax benefits that the RESP allows, I think you're doing a great job. You don't really need to shoot any higher than that.
How do you counsel clients through the question of where the incremental dollar should go? So they can eke out, let's say it's $100 a month. They are not maxing out retirement savings. How do you roll in the education savings into that discussion?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I mean, it's mostly a personal decision, but I would try to encourage people, for the most part, to put retirement savings first, if they must. The only exception to that might be, and this would be in a case like my own, for example. We had our kids fairly young. They're in university now. One's finished. One's almost finished. I'm still in my 40s. I've got enough time to catch up on my retirement savings because we prioritize those RESPs. If you have your kids a little bit later in life, and I've certainly seen it with clients who are approaching retirement themselves, still with kids who are 11, 12 years old, potentially saving in RESPs, I don't really recommend putting your own retirement income at risk so you can prioritize RESPs, because again, you kind of are running out of time, whereas your kids aren't.
Yeah. Right?
And they have other ways that they can fund their university education if it's not through you. And honestly, I don't know that parents really need to feel that they should pay for every dime of their kids' education.
Yeah.
If they can't afford that, you know, it's their own lifestyle.
Yeah, for lots of reasons. Even just having the child develop some resilience and focus for themselves. I have one last question here, and that is, what's your number one piece of advice as people think through the asset allocation? So they find the money, they can scrape away, you know, $100 a month, it goes into some sort of low-cost vehicle. How should they be thinking about equity versus fixed income, or said another way, the level of risk that they take in that fund?
Yeah, so there's theory and practice here. I mean, one of the theories is that when your kid is very young, you can afford to take a lot of risk with the investments, and that makes sense in theory. But in practice, let's remember that an RESP is going to be a very small account for the most part, and it's going to be very small, especially when your kids are young. If you're only going to put in $2,500 a year max, and many parents aren't even putting in that much, does it really matter what your asset allocation is? I mean, do you really want to try to shoot the lights out with high returns when you've only got a couple of $1,000 invested? So my argument here is that I would rather keep the investments quite conservative and just keep them fairly conservative right until your kid is into high school. You know, 50-50 is a good allocation, half stocks, half bonds.
Dan, appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks very much. Dan Bortolotti is a financial advisor with PWL Capital and the author behind the Canadian Couch Potato. Well, stay with us. Coming up next on the program, what might be preventing you from savings is not your money, but rather your mind. We'll learn more about behavioral science and the science behind saving. We'll also take you through the Moolala questionnaire. Now, let's talk about book clubs for a second. I know you probably read fiction, but how about changing it up and bringing some Moolala into your book club? You can find and order either of my two personal finance books online. You can even go to the library. I love the library. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Spending money is so easy. A latte here, a jacket there, a nice bottle of wine. But saving is hard. And a lack of income can make it hard to save. But research shows that for many, the problem lies elsewhere. Turns out that psychological obstacles might actually be the cause of your inability to save money. Here to tell us more is Evry's behavioral economist, Stephanie Bank. Hello there.
Hi.
We talk about behavioral economics a lot, but given that that's what you do for a living, can you give us how you would answer at a cocktail party? What's behavioral economics?
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure. So the world is really designed assuming that we are rational agents, and economists have based most of their theories on something called expected utility theory. And this suggests that we are rational, risk-averse profit maximizers.
Sounds like me. I am there I am. You've defined me.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I totally am not.
One of the lucky ones out there, I would say. So it'd be really rational to use your paycheck, for instance, to pay off any outstanding debt. However, people would much prefer use it for something enjoyable, like going on a vacation. So in the 70s, there were some behavioral economists. Two of them who are very well-known Nobel Prize winners include Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And their research basically found that we are not these rational agents. In fact, we are quite irrational. So they did a whole bunch of research on the psychology of decision making and identified two parts of the brain that control two different types of decision making. One of them they called system one. And this is really the automatic part of the brain. It controls all of the thinking that's very emotional. It's very automatic. We don't think about it at all. And it's really a part of the brain that is one of the oldest parts of the brain that we have. This would control something like desiring cake or taking your daily commute. On the other hand, they identified this system two, which is the more rational part of the brain. It controls all of the thinking that's more difficult, more effortful. It's where we do all of our deductive reasoning, and that's the system two. So this would control things like counting calories or taking an unfamiliar journey where it requires more cognitive resources to do what you need to do.
Based on that work, I love that definition. Based on that work, what are some of the things that are most relevant to the notion of savings? Is it some people have more mastery over their systems two thinking or what?
Yeah, I mean, we think that a lot of decisions are made with some purposeful thought that goes into some optimal decision. And then the outcome of that decision is a perfect action. But in reality, most decision-making processes have a lot of different factors or variables that happen along that journey. And in behavioral economics, we call them heuristics or mental biases or shortcuts that people take when they're making decisions. So as you mentioned earlier, the world is designed to make us really good spenders but really bad savers. And there are a couple heuristics that we can tie back to that.
For example?
Yeah, for example, the first one is that money is really abstract. So it's really hard for people to conceptualize a numerical value. So there's something called absolute value of money versus relative value of money. How many times have you stood at the grocery store and wavered between the $3 tomatoes versus the $6 tomatoes? But when you're making a much bigger purchase, like buying a television, that $3 is really irrelevant in your decision-making process. If we were rational, that $3 would carry the same value in any decision-making circumstance.
Time discounting or temporal discounting is one of the big theories out there. And it is something that makes it so difficult for young people in particular to save for retirement. Tell us about the theory and the impact that that can have on people when it relates to money.
Right. So hyperbolic discounting, as time discounting, another name for it, is the idea that people value the present much more than they value the future. We really have this present focus bias, and it's very hard to conceptualize ourselves in the future. So we make decisions that offer immediate gratification. There was a lot of research that's been done in this area. But for instance, if I offered you $100 now versus $110 in a year from now, you would probably pick the $100 now, assuming that, you know, you didn't need this $100 desperately. You'd still go for that money because it gives you immediate gratification.
Right.
However, if I said to you, I'll give you $100 in a year from now or $110 2 years from now, you'd probably pick the latter option because in the future, it's this very distant time away, and you can wait the $10 in the future. So we have very different perspectives, and that's why it's so hard to save for retirement. It's so hard to do anything that is sort of short-term pain but offers long-term gain.
Now, the company that you work for, is endeavoring to get a handle on this and develop some interventions or a way to enable its users to save more money. What are some of the things that you're learning as the app is in market? People are playing around with it. What are some of the things that you're learning?
So one of the most important things for us to overcome this delayed discounting or this hyperbolic discounting is to get people to set goals. This also helps make the abstract notion of money much more concrete. And what we do is we help people break down those larger goals into smaller goals so that as they achieve these milestones, they feel closer to actually achieving their greater goal in the future. The other thing that we really focus on is coaching. So it's not useful to give people information when it's not relevant at the time of decision making. However, we use coaching within our platform, within our app, to really give people the information that they need to stay on track and stay motivated at the time of decision making so that they can overcome that immediate temptation and recognize what's good for them in the future.
There are a lot of people out there who would tie their ability or inability to save to temperament. Maybe family of origin programming, but maybe they just say, listen, I'm a spender. Is it futile for those people, or are there ways that you believe we can, like I'm God, that the industry, that our culture can improve their outcomes when it comes to savings?
Absolutely. One of the biggest problems that we're faced with is the form of payment that we use most of the time, which is our credit card. Credit cards are very abstract. It's much more concrete to actually pay for something with dollar bills. It also activates something that we call the pain of paying, which is really an emotional pain that we experience when we're giving something up, like our money. And by paying with credit card, firstly, you don't get that pain of paying because you're not giving your cash up front. And also, you're leaving it to your future self to have to deal with that payment because you pay your bill off later in the future.
Right.
So one tactic that we could definitely use is try and use cash more than we use credit card. And that will increase the pain of paying, making it feel like we really have to make an active decision about everything that we use our money for.
Do I really want those tomatoes? I want a can of tomatoes. This is much cheaper. Stephanie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephanie Bank is a behavioral economist. She works with Evri. Time now for the Moolah La Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money, and our guest is Ian Gillespie. He is the CEO and founder of IGG Software, the company behind Banktivity, a personal finance piece of software for Mac devices. So, Ian, I want the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
I think so.
How would you describe your money personality?
Dedicated.
Dedicated. And was this always the way it was for you, or was this a personality that unfolded over time?
This is something that unfolded over time, but there was a specific time in my life where it kind of switched over. And I was camping with my aunt one time, and she mentioned that basically she tracked every bit of her finances, and I was in college at the time, and I was blown away. Could not believe it. I was like, you really track everything? And, you know, from that point on, I've sort of become a believer in, if you want to make real financial change, you want to understand your finances better than anybody else, because ultimately, you know, you have your finances' best interest in mind.
Yeah. What is one financial behavior that you're still working on? Just a little bit. Unless you're perfect. Maybe you're perfect.
Of course not. Come on. Nobody's perfect. I would say impulse. You know, there are times when I get really excited about something, whether it be something that I'm thinking about buying, and I go online and I start looking, and it's like, oh, man, I really want that new pair of skis. Wow. Think about how much fun it would be to hit the slopes with those. Or sometimes if, you know, I'm at the store and, oh, my gosh, it's an incredible sale. I've never seen that markdown so much. You know, I fell victim to the impulse buy and then can end up with some buyer's remorse.
What's one thing you worry about when it comes to money?
Oh, gosh. I'd really try not to worry about too much about money. I guess if I had to choose one thing, it would probably be more of the you know, global state of the economy. And it's nice to be in a country that's as wealthy as the United States. And I would like to see, you know, the United States and really other countries, you know, to be in a economically healthy situation.
Mm. What does financial freedom mean to you?
To me, that means what I would say would be reaching FIRE, financially independent, retire early. And that is having enough wealth that it generates enough income for you to live the lifestyle of your choosing.
And the acronym is FIRE. I don't even know what to make of that. My God.
Yes. Financially independent, retire early.
Financially independent, retire early. Now, if you were to land a huge financial windfall, say $25 million, what would you do with it?
You know, first I would think about ways to give it away. Not necessarily all of it. I'm sure I, you know, want to keep a big portion of it, but I would definitely be looking to organizations to share some of that wealth. And then, you know, from there it would be just trying to be responsible with it. You know, putting into the right investments and savings vehicles to have it work for me and you know, be generating some income to live off of.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large that did not involve your product, what would it be? What would be the one behavior you would magically change?
Do I get a finger snap?
I'm ready for yours. Go.
Okay.
That was good.
My snap. It would be avoid credit card debt. That's the one behavior that I think that could make a huge difference if people could avoid getting into that credit card debt that they, you know, are getting hit with these high interest amounts.
And if you were to give a your number one tip on avoiding credit card debt, what would it be?
I guess, you know, look at your savings rate. That ultimately boils it down, whether you're slipping into debt or not. If I had to give one more maybe totally practical tip would be either don't use it, right? If you don't use the credit card, you can't go into debt, or be diligent about it and make sure that you're always going to be able to pay off what you spend by using, you know, envelope budgeting or something like that, where it makes it really easy. You always know that you're not spending more than you have.
More than you've got. Well, Ian, thank you very much for your time and your perspective. I really appreciate it.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Ian Gillespie is CEO and founder of IGG Software, which is the company behind Banktivity. That is our program for today. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can drop us a line to ask@moolala.ca. You can also keep up with me on Facebook, Bruce Elry Moolala, or on Twitter, @BruceElry. If you want to listen to more of Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca. You can listen to both full shows and segments there. And you can go to iTunes as well. Download the full podcast version of this radio show. Write a review. Subscribe even so the next episode just shows up on your device. We appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.